death, and would see more still. She'd lost a bondmate, his memory haunting her like a ghost. The people of Norris gathered in the open area, many layers thick all the way to the walls. Regardless of age, background, or gender, they all looked hardened, as if layers of sediment had collected on their skin. Even the children had a stony look in their eyes, their lips tight and grim. None were strangers to a life on the front lines of an endless war. It made Roan wonder why any of them stayed in this place. Someone had to, he supposed, or their enemies would march straight through to the next town. The king halted his horse and, flanked by his sons, addressed the crowd, his voice booming across the village, echoing off the walls.
"Long have the people of Norris defended our land from our northern and western foes."
His words were met with silence. No cheers, no smiles, just flat, determined faces. The silence didn't seem to bother Horan Ironclad, who let it drag on for several long moments, until Roan began to feel uncomfortable in his saddle. Finally, he continued,
"You may be called into service once again, for we ride for Raiders Pass. For many years the Northern Bear has tormented our border towns, but now the beast is weak and confused. We shall tickle him under the chin, and then slash his throat."
Again, no one cheered, but this time many of the people raised blades in the air, pointing at the sky. Their jaws were locked, and Roan felt like they were on the verge of rushing into battle this very moment.
"We will have our vengeance for what they did to your queen. We will fight for Queen Henna Ironclad, mine departed wife, mine heart, a warrior in this life and in the next."
"Aye!"
the people finally screamed. Roan could see in their eyes what the queen had meant to them.
"Alas, if we are defeated at Raiders Pass," the king said, "the Northerners will counter. Norris will be the first line of defense. So now I must ask you, O defenders of the East, are you prepared for battle?"
"Aye!"
a chorus of voices responded, men, women, and children.
"Are you prepared to die for your fellow countrymen? For your brothers and sisters, and mothers and fathers and children?"
"Aye!
Are you prepared to be a shield to those you love?"
Gareth spurred his horse forward, riding in a tight circle before the villagers. He raised his sword in the air.
"Aye!"
he shouted.
"Aye!"
the people replied.
"Shield! Shield! Shield!"
"Good,"
the king said.
"Now prepare for war."
Prince Gareth had been polishing the same breastplate for so long, Roan had managed to water and feed his horse, brush its knotted mane, wash his own soiled skin, and collect plates of rations, some kind of meat and potatoes, he gave his meat to the prince, for the both of them. Yet still the prince polished, his muscles taut, sweat dripping off his chin, splashing on the metal, which gleamed like a red star under the lantern light. "Ho, Gareth," Roan said, sitting beside him. Prince Gareth was alone, sitting in the grass, well away from any of the night fires. Only a small lantern provided light as he worked. Still he scrubbed at the metal, his concentration unbroken. Roan sat beside him, watching. "Eat," Roan said, pushing the plate toward the prince. "I managed to procure double meat rations for you. I said it was because you needed enough for both yourself and your ego." It was meant as a bit of light banter, but the prince only grunted and continued his work. "Careful, you might rub a hole through the armor, and then your heart will be unprotected," Roan said. Gareth shoved the breastplate aside, and it clattered against the rest of his armor. "Sorry, I..." Roan started to say, but the prince held up a hand to silence him. He reached for the plate.
"Thank you," he said. "I know the meat was yours."
Roan said, "I wasn't that hungry."
"You never eat your meat,"
Gareth said, chewing loudly. "I'm surprised you noticed," Roan said, spearing a potato.
"I notice a lot of things."
Something about the way the prince said it made Roan pause. "Like what?"
Roan asked, waiting for Gareth to make a jest at his expense. He didn't.
Like how rain can look like tiny crystals when struck directly by sunlight, the prince said. Like how in the springtime the wind will blow the long grass, and you can almost imagine its dancing. Like how the golden stars remained fixed in formation in the sky, like a well-trained army wearing jeweled armor. Like how my own father refuses to look me in the eye, even now, on the eve of the battle where I die.
Roan stopped chewing, unable to look away from the prince.
That's not true, he said. Which part?
The prince looked up from his plate to meet Roan's stare.
I don't know about the rain, or the stars, or the grass, but you're not going to die.
The prince laughed mirthlessly.
I was born to die, he said.
The man sitting beside him was a far cry from the warrior who'd raised his sword in front of the people of Norris. Which version was the real prince? Roan wondered. He couldn't imagine living day to day, knowing his fate was sealed the moment he was born. Or could he? In a way, he and the prince weren't that different. He'd borne the weight of a fate mark his entire life, one his guardian had kept secret until the day when
it would be brought forth for all the realm to see.
Whatever that meant.
What if you don't die? Roan asked.
The prince cocked his head to the side.
I don't understand. What if you all live? All three princes? Your father? What if you are victorious tomorrow and avenge your mother?
The lines in Gareth's forehead deepened. He seemed genuinely puzzled by the question.
Then I shall live to die on another day.
Although Roan knew he meant it as a statement for his own future.
That would be true for any man, Roan said.
It's truer for me,
Gareth said.
What if your father dies and you do not?
Roan asked, changing tact.
That won't happen,
Gareth responded immediately. There was no doubt in his statement.
Why not?
Because I won't let it.
Why not?
Because it's my duty,
the prince shouted, grabbing his plate and throwing it like a saucer, the meat and potatoes flinging off in a spiral of discarded food. The words felt like knives, penetrating Roan's flesh.
Duty.
He'd never understood that word. Why was it anyone's duty to die?
Sorry, he said. I didn't mean to...
He trailed off, not sure what to say.
It's fine. You didn't grow up in the East. You can't possibly understand our traditions.
The prince was right. On this point, they would have to agree to disagree. But there was still more that Roan wanted to know, so he changed the subject. What does Gwendolyn's fate mark do? He asked.
She still hasn't told you.
The prince's typical smirk formed on his lips, and Roan was surprised to find himself glad to see it. He much preferred the sarcastic, laid-back prince he'd met in the barren marshes.
I haven't asked.
Why not? The prince raised an eyebrow.
Because she generally looks ready to cut out my tongue if I say or ask the wrong thing.
The prince laughed.
That sounds about right. But she did say her skin mark was like mine in some way. Is she a healer? He knew it didn't make sense, but nothing else did either.
Clearly she couldn't heal, or she would have healed Bark herself. And she moved like the wind, but was that her mark, or simply because she was a pure Orion?
Not exactly, Gareth said.
She bears the hero mark.
Once she told me that it forces her into dangerous situations. She can't control herself.
Time stopped. That word again.
Hero.
He remembered what Gwendolyn had said about the word.
That word is meaningless.
Yet she wore a mark that represented it. He squinted into the torchlight, relishing the spots dancing across his vision, clearing his mind.
He tried to understand.
An arrow was knocked against a bowstring, and it all made sense.
Why Gwendolyn would rush into a pox-riddled town with little hope of saving anyone. Why the king didn't try to stop her, couldn't stop her.
Why he didn't reprimand her for being so adamant.
She can't turn away from someone in need." He said it like a question, but he knew it was true before the prince nodded. "No wonder she thinks me a coward," Roan thought. "She's the bravest person in the Four Kingdoms." Roan thought back to all the times in his life when he turned his back on people who needed his help, people he could have helped. All because of one time when he'd helped a girl with a broken leg and it had gone all wrong, horribly wrong. "I'm a fool," Roan said. "I can't argue with you there," Gareth said. Despite the prince's jape and the way Gwendolyn had treated him earlier, Roan knew he would miss them both when he escaped. But their war was not his war, and he had the power to stop at least one of the major conflicts tearing the Four Kingdoms apart. Aye, his path was leading in a different direction, toward his true home. Time had run out, and he didn't even know what any of these people meant to him. "Nothing," he thought. He chuckled at his own lie. "What?" Gareth said, narrowing his eyes. Roan didn't know when exactly the prince had gone from being his enemy to his friend, but in this moment he felt like he could be even more. "In another world, perhaps," Roan said to himself. "Have your senses dulled?" the prince asked. Roan couldn't look away from the amused curl to his lips, the sparkle in his eyes, the way his hair fell across his forehead. He leaned forward, hoping against hope that he wasn't being the fool the prince thought him to be. Gareth stiffened, but didn't pull back. Even as his lips met Roan's, even as Roan reached up to touch his chin, which was as smooth as polished armour. Roan breathed him in, and the prince seemed to do the same until— "What the hell?" Gareth said, jerking back, scrubbing at his lips with the back of his hand. He glared at Roan. I'm sorry. I thought—" Gareth stood up, grabbing his armour. "I don't know what is acceptable conduct in the South, but I'm a man, not some tender-gloved boy." Something felt strange about the prince's reaction, like he was forcing it. He had let the kiss linger for a moment, hadn't he? Roan could still feel his heart galloping, his nerves firing. Their kiss, no matter how short-lived, had not rang false. "Our customs are different in the South," Roan said. "Clearly," Gareth said. He stomped away, almost forcing the grace out of his usual stride. Roan watched him go, wondering whether he would ever see him again. 27. The Northern Kingdom, Gearhert, Anis Gerick. Terrin was waiting for Anis and Zelda upstairs, where four beds had been made up in a single room with a peaked ceiling. The only window was open, a chill wind drifting through, blowing a lacy white curtain around it like a marauding poltergeist. "You made it," Anis said by way of greeting. The glow of the wall sconces gave Terrin's armour the appearance of being filled with sunlight.
"So did you."
"I thought men weren't allowed in the Laughing Mammoth, then."
"Shall I leave?"
Anis laughed. "You'll have to take it up with Netta."
Netta appeared right on cue, hefting a pail of steaming water, which she poured into a large iron tub.
"Take what up with me?"
"He's a man," Anis pointed out.
"He could be anything beneath all that metal," she said. "Plus, men are only barred from using the front door. Through the window is fine."
There was a mischievous gleam in her eye as she moved to slam the window shut against the cold. She turned back to face them.
"Anyway, you are my only guests tonight, so we can make an exception, as we already have for Lady Zelda's escort."
"Aunt,"
Anis said, turning to Zelda, who had made herself comfortable on one of the beds.
"You have a man with you?"
"My husband," Zelda said.
She punched her pillow three times, creating a nest in the centre for her head. Anise's mouth hung open.
"You're married?"
"Not openly," Zelda said. "It was a small private ceremony."
"Did my father know?"
"Not exactly. That would have ruined everything."
Anis blinked.
She was clearly missing something important. Before she could consider what, footsteps approached from the staircase. A familiar ruddy face appeared in the doorway, and Anise almost fainted. Sir Craig. The knight offered a half-grin and tipped back a tin flask, swallowing twice. He pushed it toward Anise.
Thirsty?
He said. Frozen hell. My aunt is married to this drunkard. Thank you, but no. I prefer to have my wits about me. She remembered the last two times she'd seen him, first in the melee when he'd made a fool of himself, and then just before her father fell to his death. On both occasions he'd been drunk, which was no surprise. Try it, Zelda said. Anise turned toward her aunt, unable to hold back an angry frown. I'll pass. I am no lush.
Neither is my husband, Zelda said, smiling.
Anise looked back at the man she'd always known as Drunk Craig, or simply Sir Drunk. His eyes were as clear as blown glass, his stance steady, and somehow taller than usual. His words were equally crisp as he said, "It's only water," once more offering her the flask. She took it, shaking her head. "Aye, and I bear half a dozen skin marks," she said. She sniffed the flask's mouth. To her surprise, it was odorless. She spilled a few drops onto her fingers, studying the clear liquid. Licked her fingers clean. The substance was basically tasteless, like water. "Taking a break from the drink?" she asked Sir Craig.
"I've never had a drink in my life," Craig said.
Anise was about to bring up numerous times in the past when the knight was obviously inebriated, but Zelda spoke first.
"It's true. He may not be a drunkard, but he is a damn good actor."
Anise didn't know what to say, what to think.
"Why?"
was all she could manage to splutter out.
"He is my castle spy," Zelda said.
Anise's gaze travelled from Craig to her aunt and back again. Craig shrugged.
"Men have loose tongues when they believe they speak to drunken ears," he said. She was dumbfounded.
More surprised than if Terin had declared himself a woolly yak and stripped off his armour to prove it.
"Then I have sorely misjudged you," she said.
"For that, I am sorry."
He shrugged again.
"It was my deception, not yours."
"Still, I have given you less credit than you likely deserved. I laughed with the rest when you stumbled through each tournament in last place."
Craig laughed.
"I am no warrior. Feigning drunkenness was as good excuse as any to avoid combat. In battle I might as well be drunk, for I am a clumsy man. Even my knighthood was gained by accident. Thankfully, your aunt saw something more in me than a witless fool."
"Yes, a courageous spy and gentle lover," she said.
Anise looked at Terin.
"Don't look at me," he said. "I knew of many secrets, but not this. This was well kept."
Netta returned with another pail of steaming water. She poured it into the tub, which was almost full.
"It is late. I thought you might enjoy a bath before bed."
She would, but here. The tub was in the centre of the small room, the four beds lined up like seats for spectators. Anise was confident the show would be both a comedy and tragedy.
"The others will not peek," Netta promised.
She offered a glare at both Craig and Terin.
"Will they?"
Terin immediately closed his eyes and blundered toward the far bed, nearly tripping on the footpost, which was low to the ground.
"You don't have to close your eyes yet," Anise said.
"Oh,"
he said, his eyes twinkling when he opened them. He eased onto the bed, his metal armor causing quite a ruckus. Anise shook her head. She still couldn't believe he was able to sleep in full battle armor. Craig settled in beside Zelda, covering his face with a pillow.
"See,"
Netta said.
"Can I help you undress?"
"No," Anise said, too quickly.
"I mean, thank you, but I will be fine. Even in Castle Hill I wouldn't allow the maidservants to fuss over me. Nor see me naked."
"As you wish."
She placed a towel beside the tub, along with a dressing gown.
Call if you need anything. I will not sleep on this night.
Thank you.
Annice watched her go, waiting until the door had closed behind her. She scanned her companions, who seemed too random to be anything but real. Zelda was already snoring, her blanket tucked up under her chin. Annice had so many questions she still needed to ask her aunt, but they would have to wait until morning. Craig's breathing was heavy, a mountain of pillows blocking his view even if he were to open his eyes. Despite his lifelong deception, she felt inclined to trust his honour. Then there was Terrin, lying on his back, his feet hanging well over the edge of the bed. She wondered whether there was a bed in the entire northern kingdom that could fit him. She couldn't tell if he was awake, so she made her way over to him, waving a hand across his eye slits.
"I can't see you, but I can hear you," he said.
Annice peeled up a corner of the blanket and stuffed it inside his mask's eye slit.
"Thank you," Terrin said. "That will help with the temptation to steal a peek."
Annice had the urge to hit him, but feared the sound of her fist banging his armor would wake the other two. She settled for stuffing the blanket in further.
"I feel as if I have cotton in my eyes," Terrin said.
"Good," Annice retorted. "Now sleep, you big buffoon, or I'll be forced to hurt you."
Before she'd removed a single layer of clothing, Annice already felt naked and exposed. Now, as she pulled off her woolen overcoat, cotton underlayer, thick breeches, wool-insulated boots, double-layered socks, and, finally, underclothing, Annice was acutely aware that Terrin could easily pull the blanket out of his eye slits, open his eyes, and see the real her, pale and muscular and curvy and ill at ease in her own skin. The thought made her practically dive into the steaming water, the level rising precariously, nearly sloshing over the sides. She peeked out to find her trio of companions in the same positions she'd left them. Taking a deep breath, she gave herself over to the steam and warm water, which chased away the chill that had settled deep in her bones for days. She fumbled along the bottom of the tub until she found a sponge and a bar of soap, using them to clean her body from head to toe. When she was finished, she felt human again. As she climbed from the tub, toweled off, donned the dressing gown, and slipped into bed, she wondered how long the feeling would last. The next day dawned bright, cold, and eager. Annice yawned, pulling the blankets over her head as white light streamed through the window. Armor creaked nearby. Hushed voices spoke. With a sigh, Annice threw off the covers and sat up. Terrin was helping Netta empty the washing tub. For each pail she carried, he hefted four, two in each hand. Zelda and Sir Craig sat on the edge of one of the beds, conferring softly. They seemed to be arguing.
"Morning,"
Annice said, to no one in particular.
"That's what they call it when the sun rises," Terrin said.
His eyes met hers just before he turned away, hauling the pails to wherever Netta had asked him to. Sir Craig stood and offered a half-bow.
"Queen Garrick," he said,
and then left before Annice could argue the formal title. Zelda watched him go and then stood. She approached Annice, sitting next to her. It was so strange being with her aunt in any capacity. Like with Sir Craig, she judged Zelda wrongly in so many ways, succumbing to the rumours that she was a strange recluse who'd completely separated herself from reality. A recluse, maybe, and certainly strange. But Aunt Zelda's eyes were sharp and clear and focused. Frozen hell! She'd had her husband pretending to be a drunk in order to spy on the king.
"I want to clear Archie's name," Annice said,
the words springing to her lips before she could consider their origin. Why did it matter what the kingdom thought of her brother? She wanted to flee to the hinterlands with him anyway. Or perhaps to Crimea, like her mother had wanted.
"Because he will never leave the northern kingdom," she realized.
It was a truth she'd been hiding from him for a while, using her dream of carving a life elsewhere as a shield. And if Arch was determined to be king, to rule the north, the people would need to trust him, or at the least respect him. Or fear him, she thought, like they had her father. Zelda shook her head.
"Your brother's name doesn't need to be cleared," she said. "I was there," Anise argued. "I saw my father die. It wasn't Arch. It was something I can't explain. A ghost that looked like another version of Arch."
"The truth doesn't matter," Zelda said. "The people already love your brother. Thinking he killed the Dread King of the North will only make them love him more."
Anise frowned. She hadn't considered that the Northerners might be happy about her father's death. He'd ruled with fear for so many years, it made sense. She remembered what had happened at the execution, the way the spectators had reacted when Arch was brought out in chains. Appalled. Shocked.
"Fine. So we let them believe he was guilty of treason. That doesn't change the fact that he's being hunted by your brother's soldiers. Trust me, they'll do anything to find him. To find me. We need to locate Arch before Lord Griswold does."
Zelda nodded.
"There's something else you need to know, although Sir Craig thinks it's too soon to tell you."
"What else could there be?"
Anise wondered. It was like the secrets kept pouring from her aunt's mouth in a steady stream.
"What? Tell me. I cannot bear to be in the dark any longer."
"Your brother is alive," Zelda said.
"How can you be certain?"
"You haven't seen Arch in—" "Not Arch," Zelda said.
Anise licked her lips. Surely she didn't mean... Anise stood up, her hand rising automatically to comb her hair, still damp from her bath the night before.
"I saw the blood," she said. "I was the one. I was so excited to meet him, to have a baby brother. I went to his crib. There was blood on the sheets. I screamed, I—"
She bit her own hand, fighting back the nightmare that had haunted her sleep for years. Though Anise had only been 4 years old, the memory was as vivid as any other. There had been grey fur everywhere, stuck to the blood. The wolves had killed her baby brother and dragged him away. Mired in grief, Anise had been sworn to secrecy by her parents. The realm couldn't know that a prince of the North had been killed by wild animals, and within the castle at that.
"Cow's blood,"
Zelda said now.
Anise shook her head. "It wasn't. I saw the fur, the wolves—" "I scattered the fur myself. I drained the blood from a water skin. I took your brother from his bed."
A tremor ran through Anise's body. Her legs faltered, buckling under her. Her aunt's hand shot out to steady her, but she flinched away, losing her balance. She collapsed in a heap, cradling her head in her hands, sobbing. These lies were too much. And if they weren't lies, she couldn't dare to hope. Her aunt spoke.
"I delivered the child to a man known as Bear Blackboots, an old friend of mine who I could trust, who would be the boy's keeper, his guardian, his protector, until he came of age. Bear was the perfect choice. He had no family left, no ties, and, like me, he hated my brother with a passion."
Anise couldn't process any of it, shaking her head back and forth again and again in denial.
"I'm sorry," Zelda said. "I had no choice under the circumstances."
Anise swiveled her head around and stared at her aunt, her moist eyes flashing with anger.
"What circumstances?"
"Your brother bore a skin mark," she said. "He bears a skin mark."
"What? Where?"
"On his scalp. A circle broken into eights by death's arrows."
"How do you know this?"
"I saw it. Your mother did, too."
Zelda sighed.
"Sabria had reason to believe one of her children would bear a mark. She received information once, a prophecy of sorts. The details aren't important, save for the fact that your mother believed it. I didn't put much stock in legend and faith, but I agreed to help her. We secretly inspected each of you after you were born.
Once we saw the mark on your brother, we agreed he had to be taken away from your father.
My mother knew.
Anise's teeth were clenched together so hard she thought they might crack under the pressure.
Yes.
A single word, like a dart to the heart.
I don't understand.
Her father would have loved him all the more for having a mark. The marks were power, and power was the only thing her father had worshipped.
It was the death mark,
Zelda said.
Your brother bears the death mark. He is responsible for your father's death.
Anise sat on the horse-drawn cart which rumbled beneath her. She was numb, not from the cold, but from her conversation with Zelda. The apparition she'd seen in the tower had been her lost brother, somehow. And he'd killed his own father, making it appear to be an unfortunate tumble down the tower steps, creating a chain of events that led to her mother's murder and their current situation.
It was the only way to stop your father,
Zelda had explained. Apparently all the time she'd spent away from the castle had been to study the prophecies of some strange witch who'd lived in the West more than a century ago. She'd once been known as the Western Oracle. Evidently her writings included information on the skin marks, which she referred to as fate marks. When her sister-in-law had given birth to the babe, and they'd shone the torchlight over his tiny scalp, they'd instantly known what the mark meant. Death. Something called the King's Plague, which, according to the Oracle's prophecies, would result in the deaths of 8 rulers, which would somehow bring peace to the 4 kingdoms. It was all very confusing to Anise, who was trying to catch up to her aunt's vast knowledge of the skin marks. Even then, Zelda had known her brother, the king, was evil. Queen Sabria Loren Garrick had known the same thing. They'd plotted against him, removing the babe from where the king might be able to hurt the boy, hoping that one day the child would return to murder his own father. But when years passed and the boy didn't return as a young man, and the dread king continued to rain terror upon the north, her mother and aunt had taken matters into their own hands, plotting to assassinate him. Anise knew what her father had been capable of. If he'd believed his own son was a threat to his throne, he would have killed him without remorse. As much as she hated losing her brother, she couldn't deny they'd likely saved his life. However, in the end, all their plotting and scheming had cost her mother her life.
"What is his name?"
she'd asked, picturing the eerie boy who had appeared on the staircase. The way he'd looked at her, his face so similar to her brother's that she couldn't deny the resemblance.
"Bear calls him Bane,"
Zelda had replied.
"King's Bane,"
Anise had immediately understood. They'd been interrupted by Netta, who'd brought breakfast, before Anise could ask anything more. But it didn't matter. She might not be a scholar of Fate Mark lore, but now she knew enough to understand what was happening. Bane had killed her father, his father, and then apparently killed King Loren in the West too, as well as most of his royal guards. 2 dead rulers, 6 to go.
"Not Arch,"
she thought now, staring at the snow-capped peaks of the mournful mountains getting closer and closer, but not really seeing them.
"Please, not Arch."
Surely the Eastern King would be next. Or perhaps one of the Southron rulers, Empress Sun Sands or Emperor Vin Hoser. Arch still had time to establish himself in the north, to build up his defences, didn't he? And anyway, her uncle had declared himself king in the north, so wouldn't he be Bane's next target? In her heart of hearts, she knew he wouldn't, because he wasn't the true king.
"Why didn't you stop Arch from leaving Gearhead?"
Anise muttered to herself. The question was meant for Zelda, but her aunt was on a different cart, trailing behind them, laden with foodstuffs for the troops at Raiders Pass. Anise was riding on a cart with Terin, piled high with gleaming weapons and armour. The carts were escorted by a company of 40 soldiers, who were evidently loyal to Lady Zelda, and who had agreed to be the first of Arch's army, joining however many soldiers he could recruit at Raiders Pass. They'd come from the east, and were more than ready for a new king. A true king. Terin had asked her thrice whether she was all right, and thrice she had simply nodded and waved away the question. He'd eventually given up, and settled in for the short ride south to the pass, where the streams spoke of an eastern legion bearing royal sigils having made camp in the shadows south of the Mournful Mountains. Anis wondered what they would find when they arrived. 28. The Eastern Kingdom, south of Raiders Pass. Rhone. They'd left the defences at Norris intact, riding out before dawn, mere shadows on a darkened landscape. No one spoke, not even Gareth, who seemed fresh out of jokes at Rhone's expense. In fact, the prince wouldn't even look at him, his eyes dancing away whenever Rhone tried to meet them. "I've ruined our friendship," he thought. "All for that one ill-advised kiss." And yet the memory of it, as short-lived as it was, warmed his heart. Gwendolyn took on the role of scout, riding well ahead of the front with two other Aurians, both male. From a distance, he could see them laughing and talking. He didn't feel jealous of them, only sad. Sad that any friendship he might have had with Gwen kept slipping further and further away. "Am I destined to be alone, devoid of friends and love?" he wondered. He gritted his teeth and rode onwards, trying to remind himself that such thoughts were childish, considering they were riding to war, and he would soon be leaving both of them anyway. They reached the Snake River at midday, the waters fresh and clean, riding high from the snowmelt to the north. The current was strong, and Rhone wondered whether he'd even be able to ford the river when the time came. He was a strong swimmer, but there were dozens of places where a body could be smashed along the rocky shoreline on either side. Across the river was the Tangle, an immense forest that had a reputation for being nearly impenetrable, due to the dense foliage full of vines, roots, and spiky plants known to carry poison that caused fever and night chills. And yet, despite the dangers, the forest was alluring. The first time Rhone had laid eyes on the west since he was a baby. All of the answers to his questions about why his mother had to die so he could live, and whether his father knew exactly what she'd done, were there, just ready to be discovered. He could almost see them in the shifting branches, in the fluttering leaves. The answer to Rhone's biggest question of all, "Can I make a difference in the course of the Hundred Years' War?" felt close enough to touch. Nearby, Guy Ironclad spat in the dirt. "An awful place, aye?" he said, noticing Rhone's gaze toward the west. "If their god, Roth, was wise, he would let the west sink into the sea." "Aye," Rhone said. Maybe it was better that no one spoke to him. "An awful place." For now, Rhone would continue riding directly north with the war party, biding his time until he could slip away. Paused by the river, they watered their horses, ate a light lunch, and moved out across the plains, which were flat and packed hard. The weather began to change as the mountains loomed larger in the distance. First it was a cold breeze slipping through gaps in his clothing, but swiftly became an icy wind, blowing hard enough to make him shiver. He pulled the cloak that was tied to his reins free and wrapped it around his shoulders. Snow began to fall. The edges of the river were frozen. Then the middle, the entire body of water crusted with ice that looked thick enough to walk upon. Rhone licked his lips, eyeing the river. Would it really be that simple? Could he just walk across? Even the forest looked less tangled, with wide gaps between the trees. Gareth cruised over to him, smiling. His eyes met Rhone's, and there was no awkwardness there. "Thank the gods," Rhone thought. "The northerners must be mad to live in a place like this," he said. "Their skin must be thicker than ours, don't you think?" Rhone couldn't help but to agree, though he was pleased to see the easygoing smile back in its place on the prince's face. Something about it wasn't quite right, like he'd used a quill and some ink to draw it on.
The South Runners would have already retreated, Roan said. They are not built for such weather. And neither am I, which is one of many reasons I'll be going west.
You speak of the Southerners as if you are not one of them, Gareth noted.
As I've said, I'm only half South Runner, Roan said, mentally berating himself for his loose tongue. I remember now. Something about a Western father, right? Roan froze, pretending the question meant nothing to him, that he was simply mesmerized by the sheer size of the monstrous peaks rising before them. The mountains were a mix of black, green, and white. The green was at the bottom, the black in the middle, and only white at their heights, capped with snow. He was cold now. He couldn't imagine what the temperature must feel like atop the cliffs.
Impressive, aye? Gareth said, noticing his wide eyes.
Roan was glad the prince had changed the subject. Raider's Pass cuts between the mountains, right? Roan asked.
Aye.
The river has created a thin canyon. There's a path along the river, but it's rocky and difficult. Years ago, when the North and the West were still willing to trade, the pass was ruled by bands of raiders who ransacked the numerous caravans and barges that made the trek between the kingdoms.
Hence the name, Roan said.
Hence. Now the pass is the front lines in the Hundred Years' War. It's the only geographical point where the Western, Eastern, and Northern kingdoms meet. Much blood has been spilt between the shoulders of the mournful mountains.
And much more will be spilt, Roan thought. But I won't be around to see it.
The king and his retinue had stopped up ahead. The battalion formed ranks behind him. Regardless of what Roan thought of their traditions and intentions, he couldn't deny the quality of the Eastern training. The soldiers, whether male or female, Aurean or human, were obedient and well-organized. Before the sun fell beneath the horizon, the camp was erected, the horses tended and shielded from the wind, fires made, supper cooked, and water barrels filled. Gareth disappeared into a secret meeting with his father and brothers. The only other attendee was Bjorn Stonesledge with his iron mark. Roan lounged by one of the larger fires, internally chuckling at the three soldiers who pretended not to watch him, but who he knew had been assigned to guard him. Without being bound or jailed, he was a prisoner just the same. But not for long. To his surprise, a slim figure stepped into the firelight and sat down beside him. In the moon and firelight, her silvery hair almost appeared as white as the snow on the mountains. Gwendolyn spoke without looking at him, staring into the flames.
"Thank you for saving my life. And the girls. I should have said it before, but all I could feel was anger and sadness. I tried to save Bark's life, too," Roan said. "I swear it. I know. I have trouble with failure. I think those with marks feel it more."
He remembered swinging from her hammock.
"How do you know the Westerners once called them fate marks?" Roan asked. "My father told me. He told me about the Western Oracle. He said she'd prophesied about the fate marks, about how they could one day bring peace to the four kingdoms." "How? Why are you so interested in the West all of a sudden?"
"Gwen, I can't tell you everything. I want to, but I can't."
She chewed on this for a while, and then sighed with resignation.
"I don't know what he meant about the fate marks, but I'm not certain he did, either. Twice he mentioned rumors of a peacemaker, one of the marked. According to the Oracle, this was the one who would unify the kingdoms and bring peace. But no one seems to know for certain. Most of the Oracle's teachings were lost. No one knows what happened to her. Some say she died, executed by the Western King. Some say she just ceased to exist. And others believe she's still alive, hiding somewhere, waiting for peace to return. What do you believe?"
"That there's always hope for a better world."
"She's lost so much, and still she has hope."
"Because of your hero, Mark?"
Her eyes darted to his, surprised, but then moved back to the fire.
"I don't know. Perhaps. It's like I can feel the souls of the dead crying out to me."
Roan's heart skipped a beat.
I understand.
Do you?
There was frustration in her voice. Not anger, not yet, but resentment. He'd heard the same cries. The girl he'd healed so long ago. The boy who'd been unlucky enough to be with her at the time. And since then, so many more. People he could have helped, but didn't. An entire island of souls on Dragon's Breath alone. And now the village of Glee. But one cry seemed to rise above all others, louder and stronger than he'd ever felt before. His mother's. Now, this close to the west, this close to his birthplace, Roan needed more than ever to understand what had happened to set his life on this course. Roan shook his head, the horrific images burning through his mind.
Yes, I understand, but at least I have a choice.
Gwendolyn muttered a curse under her breath. Roan frowned. Had he said something wrong? He was about to ask when Gwen said,
I've lied about my mark my entire life.
Roan had no idea what she meant, or how to respond, so he just waited for her to continue, which she did.
Everyone believes my mark forces me into dangerous situations, but in truth it doesn't.
Then what does it do? Memories bloomed in Roan's head. Gwen moving like the wind, as strong as a man twice her size, dragging a small girl to safety.
You don't know?
He did know. His mouth cracked open with realization. The only force compelling Gwen to rush to save the lives of others was herself. All her life she'd been hiding the truth.
Because why?
Because she doesn't want to be given credit for her selfless acts, Roan realized.
You are a true hero, he said.
And not because of your hero, Mark. Gwen cast her eyes downwards.
Perhaps I just don't want to waste the power I've been given.
It's not what Roan wanted to hear, because it implied his own failings. Not to mention his future failings, if he were to run from the impending battle before it started. How many would die because of his choice?
You never asked for your mark.
Neither did I, he said. Gwendolyn suddenly grabbed his arm, and her fingers were so hot they practically burned his skin. But still, he didn't flinch away, his heart an entire battalion of thundering hoofbeats in his chest.
So what? Gwendolyn said. Do you think anyone asks for what they're born with? Do you think I asked for the speed and strength to save some, but not all? Do you think I wanted to outlive most of my friends? To see death and life alternate like the changing of the seasons?
She gripped his arm tighter still, and Roan could feel the beat of his heart in his veins beneath her fingertips.
It's not what you start with. It's what you do with what you've been given, Gwen said.
Seeing the passion on her face, feeling the heat from her fingertips on his skin, this heroic woman had never looked more beautiful. She smelled of jasmine and steel, leather and talc. He wanted to taste her passion, to feel her warmth flowing through him, to discover whether his heart galloped when he kissed her as it had when he'd kissed Gareth. He remembered Gareth's rejection, the anger in his eyes. He didn't move. As frozen as the mountains. Gwen's fingers lingered a moment longer, and then she released his arm, which continued to burn, stood up, and strode into the darkness. Roan blinked, looking around to see if anyone else had observed their exchange. To his surprise, the three soldiers assigned to watch him had been reduced to one, and the last man was asleep, snoring loudly. This was exactly the chance he'd been waiting for. Like a wraith, he would slip away. He had nothing left to stay for. Whatever he felt for Gwendolyn and for Gareth was clearly not reciprocated. They would not miss him, would not care. Away from them, his life would be his own again, and this time he would make it count. Even Gwen's last words to him seemed to agree with his decision to leave. To set out on his own and make a difference in this world. His past was the key to the future. He just had to turn it in the lock of his present. He would tell no one of her secret. He stood, creeping away quietly, heading for the frozen river. The embankment was rocky, but not particularly steep, and there was even a slice of red moonlight penetrating the clouds to light his way. For once, fate seemed to be on his side. In his chest, his life mark seemed to pulse in agreement. "My fate mark," he thought, remembering the word Gwen had introduced him to. Reaching the river, he took a tentative step onto the ice. He pressed half his weight, then all of his weight. Nothing. The ice was thick and strong and didn't so much as crack or groan. He would literally be able to stroll across to the west. From there, he could follow the mountain range all the way to the Bay of Bounty, eating snow to sustain him. If necessary, he would stop in Bethany and beg for scraps. From there, it was presumably less than a week's journey to Night's End. The thought made him feel a slash of something in his chest. Was it excitement or fear? He wasn't sure. He was halfway across when he thought of Gareth. His feet stopped, almost of their own accord. Though he'd never intended it, the prince had become his reluctant friend, at the least. The prince believed he would die in the next day or so, somewhere between here and Raiders Pass. "Not my problem," Roan thought desperately. "Right? What if I turn back and die in the battle?" he thought. What if he never had the chance to return home, to face his father, to learn about the truth of his mother's death? What then? Gwen herself had pointed out that he had a responsibility to use the power he'd been given, and between his life mark and his lineage, he could make a difference more than anyone else, if he was only courageous enough to try. He took another step forward and stopped again. Took a deep breath, holding the icy air in his lungs, relishing the distraction provided by the burn in his chest. Released it, watching the white vapours escape into the frigid night air. But Gareth. But Gwendolyn. But King Ironclad and Bjorn Stonesledge and all of the other Easterners who were standing up for the death of their queen. A strong woman they respected so much they were willing to give their lives for her memory. "It's not my fight. My fight is elsewhere." Roan took two more steps forward, listening to the scrape of his boots on the ice. And then he made a decision that surprised even him. He turned around. He had a battle to stop. The war council was over, the princes and Bjorn Stonesledge having gone to bed. The rest of the soldiers slumbered too, and Roan was able to slip back into camp. He was surprised to find King Orin Ironclad still sitting by the main campfire, which had been reduced to a pile of glowing embers. Roan eased down beside him.
"You have made your choice," the large man said, staring into the dying fire.
"He knows," Roan thought. "I didn't know I had a choice," he said. The king offered a half-smile, but didn't make eye contact.
"There is always a choice, and I wasn't about to deny you yours."
Roan was dumbfounded. "You allowed me to escape?" The king stroked his thick beard thoughtfully.
"We have built our monarchy around the idea of choice. Our soldiers are free, as are our servants. They are paid well. We treat them as they are."
"And what are they?"
"People."
Now the king looked up.
"Tell me, Roan, why did you come back?"
Roan wasn't sure the king would like the answer, but it was a moment of honesty between them, and he wouldn't lie. "To stop the battle." The king nodded, as if he'd guessed as much.
"And how do you plan to do that?"
"By speaking with you. Man to man." The king laughed, a deep-throated chuckle, his eyes reflecting orange embers.
"And what would you say to me, man to man?"
There was mocking in his tone. "That this war is folly. Defend your lands, aye, but do not go on the offensive. Countless lives can still be saved, including your own sons." The king's smile faded into the firelight.
"Do not speak to me of saving lives, boy," he snarled. "I cradled the henna's head as life faded from her eyes. She'd been stabbed through the gut as she'd slept,
left by our enemies to die a slow, miserable death.
I'm sorry.
You don't get to be sorry.
The king stood, towering over Roan, his fists clenched at his sides, anger seeming to pulse from every angle of his body. Beneath his shining, bald head, his face was awash with red light, his eyes burning with something Roan had trouble identifying at first. There was a mania in his expression that Roan had not seen before. It was a mixture of anger and unspent violence and something else. Roan suddenly realized what it was. Pain. Grief. Anger so deep and fiery it was an unquenchable inferno burning beneath the surface of his skin. This man, who was typically so in control, had become a slave to his pain, which seemed to be eating him alive from the inside out.
She's dead. My blood cries for vengeance, and I will have it. Blood for blood. Death for death. If the Dread King is dead, then it falls to his wife. If she is dead, it falls to their children. If the children are dead, it shall be every northerner who stands in my way.
He bent down and grabbed the foe hammer, which had been resting beside him. With a roar, he raised it over his head and brought it down in the center of the fire, scattering blazing embers like splinters of a shattered torch. One such ember landed in Roan's lap. He sprang to his feet, brushing the ember from his trousers, which had already begun to smolder. When he looked up, the king was gone, leaving what was left of the fire to burn itself out, along with Roan's hopes of stopping the battle. 29. The Northern Kingdom, Raiders Pass. Anis Gerik. At Raiders Pass, the northern forces were preparing for battle. Men donned battle-scarred armor, sharpened swords, battle-axes and mace, and drank from waterskins. One company was beating their chests and shouting angrily at each other, as if trying to work themselves up to violence. Another company was huddled in a circle and seemed to be praying. To what god, Anise didn't know. Peeking out from under the edge of the tarp, she was so close to Terrin it was like they were joined at the hip. Zelda had stopped their caravan a while back to hide them beneath the sheets of thick canvas. Although Anise's aunt was confident they would have even more allies at the pass, she didn't want to risk her niece being identified until she was certain it was safe. Despite the cold, Anise was sweating beneath her layers. The northern edge of Raiders Pass was a rocky outcropping nestled between two enormous boulders perched at the base of the Mournful Mountains. The Snake River flowed swiftly downstream, though you couldn't tell because of the thick layer of ice on its surface, cutting a narrow canyon between the white cliffs. Eventually the river would flow into Hyrule Lake, which fed the Spear, finally emptying into the Burning Sea many leagues south. Anise scanned the camp's activity for her brother, but all the men were too tall, too broad, and too grizzled by years of war to be arch.
"Where are you?" she wondered.
That's when Terrin whispered,
"Sir Dietrich."
His head was angled to the left, and Anise followed his gaze excitedly, zeroing in on the tall, handsome knight immediately. The master swordsman stood sentry outside a large tent, his armor more dented and dinged than ever, almost like he'd purposely banged it against a sharp rock. Evidently, Zelda and her escorts had spotted him too, because the carts and soldiers diverted their path toward the tent, stopping nearby, the horses stamping their hooves in the cold. Sir Dietrich approached warily, his eyes narrowed.
"Who goes there?" he demanded, grabbing the edge of the tarp and thrusting it back with a flourish.
The snow that had gathered on top flew in the air and landed on Anise's head.
"Frozen hell," she growled. "We're supposed to be in hiding."
She grabbed the tarp and struggled to pull it back down as Sir Dietrich's eyes widened.
"Princess Anise," he said, dumbfounded. "Queen Anise, actually," she said. "Who were you expecting? An ice monster from the hinterlands?"
"Queen," he said, trailing off as if the word was spoken in a foreign language.
"She had a name day," Terrin explained.
"Arm,"
Sir Dietrich said.
"She's supposed to be at Blackstone."
"Tell her that," he muttered.
Anise was no longer listening, because she'd become aware of the fact that dozens of